destructive nature emerged between the individual with a mission to expunge the perceived national humiliation of 1918 and a society ready, more and more, to see his leadership as vital to its future salvation, to rescue it from the dire straits into which, in the eyes of millions of Germans, defeat, democracy, and depression had cast it. To encapsulate this relationship as the key to understanding how Hitler could obtain, then exercise his peculiar form of power, I turn to the concept of charismatic authority, as devised by the brilliant German sociologist Max Weber, who died before Hitler had been heard of, at least outside Munich beer halls. I did not elaborate on this concept, which had figured prominently in my writing on Hitler and the Third Reich over many years. It lay, unmistakably, however, at the heart of the inquiry. Charismatic authority, as deployed by Weber, did not rest primarily on demonstrable outstanding qualities of an individual. Rather, it derived from the perception of such qualities among a following which, amid crisis conditions, projected onto a chosen leader unique heroic attributes and saw in him personal greatness, the embodiment of a mission of salvation. Charismatic authority is, in Weber's conceptualization, inherently unstable. Continued failure or misfortune will bring its downfall, and it is under threat of becoming routinized into a systematic form of government. Applying this concept of charismatic authority seemed to me to offer a useful way of tackling both of the central questions I had posed. To my mind, the concept helps in evaluating the relationship between Hitler and the mass following that shaped his rise, though in conditions never, of course, imagined by Max Weber, and where the image of heroic leadership attached to Hitler, exploiting pre-existing pseudo-religious expectations of national salvation, was in good measure a manufactured propaganda product. And I also found it invaluable in examining the way Hitler's highly personalized rule eroded systematic government and administration and was incompatible with it. Of course, by the middle of the war, Hitler's popularity was in steep decline, and any charismatic hold over government and society was now waning sharply. By this time, however, Germany had been wedded for a decade or so to Hitler's charismatic domination. Those who owed their own positions of power to Hitler's supreme Führer authority still upheld it, whether from conviction or necessity. They had risen with Hitler. Now they were condemned to fall with him. He had left them no way out. Hitler's authority within the regime started to crumble only as Germany faced imminent and total defeat. And, as long as he lived, he posed an insuperable barrier to the only way the war he had brought about could be ended: his country's capitulation. I linked charismatic authority to another concept as a way of showing how Hitler's highly personalized form of rule functioned. This, as referred to in the text and operating as a kind of leitmotif throughout the biography, was the notion of working towards the Führer, which I tried to use to show how Hitler's presumed aims served to prompt, activate, or legitimate initiatives at different levels of the regime, driving on, consciously or unwittingly, the destructive dynamic of Nazi rule. I did not mean with this notion to suggest that people at all times asked themselves what Hitler wanted, then tried to put it into practice. Some, of course, especially among the party faithful, did more or less just that. But many others, say in boycotting a Jewish shop to protect a rival business, or denouncing a neighbour to the police on account of some personal grievance, were not asking themselves what the Führer's intentions might be, or operating from ideological motivation. They were, nevertheless, in minor ways, helping to sustain and promote ideological goals represented by Hitler and thereby indirectly promoting the process of radicalization by which those goals, in this case, racial cleansing of German society, gradually came more sharply into view as realizable short-term aims rather than distant objectives. The approach I chose meant the two volumes were necessarily long. But even beyond the text itself, there was much to be added. I was keen to provide full reference to the extensive documentary sources, both archival and printed primary sources, and the wealth of secondary literature I'd used. First, so that other researchers could follow these up and re-examine them if need be, and second, to remove distortions in